Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The first eagerly awaited shipment of grain to leave the Ukrainian port of Odessa since Russia's invasion more than 5 months ago was cleared to proceed to Lebanon on Wednesday after a scheduled inspection stopover in Istanbul. In line with the UN-partnered Black Sea Grain Initiative, the crew of the merchant vessel Razoni and its 26,000-ton cargo of Ukrainian corn underwent 3 hours of checks. The ship arrived in Istanbul's waters on Tuesday evening after sailing from Odessa on Monday. Inspectors from Russia, Turkey, Ukraine and the United Nations carried out the inspection, according to the Black Sea Grain Initiative Joint Coordination Center, which said that 3 ports in Ukraine were due to begin exporting millions of tons of wheat, corn and other crops. In addition to shipping food from Ukraine, the Black Sea Initiative also envisages the export of fertilizer needed by the world's farmers under close monitoring. To Iraq now, where it's been 8 years since ISIL fighters attacked, killed and took hostage many members of the ethnic Yazidi community. In a call to help the many thousands of Yazidis who've been unable to return home to northern Iraq, the UN said on Wednesday that many of them still suffer mental trauma after years of captivity, torture, sexual violence and slavery at the hands of the extremists. Continuing tensions have meant that many Yazidis cannot travel to their ancestral homeland in Sinjar district, which lacks the essential stability that's needed for people to rebuild their lives free of fear and intimidation, the UN said. In a statement, the UN office in Iraq insisted that it was everyone's responsibility to work relentlessly to ensure that the ongoing plight of the Yazidis ends now, with opportunities, reconstruction and public services for all. Journalists in Cambodia face increasing harassment and pressure, which has led to fear and self-censorship ahead of recent elections, the UN Human Rights Office, OHCHR, said on Wednesday. In a new report, OHCHR highlighted how a new law to prevent the transmission of COVID-19 and a decree apparently aimed at censoring information shared on social media had given the government wide-ranging powers to block information and punish unspecific crimes. Of the 65 journalists contacted for the report, all said that they'd faced interference while carrying out their work. More than 4 in 5 experienced surveillance and restrictions, including in relation to access to information. In a comment, the UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet said that a free, independent and pluralistic media played a central role in every democratic society. She urged the authorities to ensure that reporters could work fairly for the benefit of all Cambodians. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we pay tribute to our colleague and friend, journalist Glenn Ford.
Glenn Ford is certainly presente. Black Agenda Report continues under the able leadership of Margaret Kimberly, and we're fortunate enough to have a recording of the great speech that Glenn gave in 2014 at Riverside Church, and then we're going to rebroadcast an interview we did with Glenn.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
Glenn Ford died last July 28th of lung cancer. I knew Glenn the last 7 years of his life. I first met him in 2014 after a speech that he gave at New York's Riverside Church on the occasion of the 7th anniversary of the Black Agenda Report, of which he was the executive editor. The two other editors were Margaret Kimberly, who has taken over as the editor, and the late Bruce Dixon of Chicago, who died 2 years ago. They were a formidable threesome. That night, Glenn spoke about what he called the Black Misleadership Class, a description he coined, and how it was an enemy of the movement. He said the Democratic Party, which they populate, was not the lesser of two evils, but the most effective of two evils. In particular, he zeroed in on New Jersey Senator Cory Booker. I kept in touch with Glenn. He was a guest on Law and Disorder several times. I helped him assemble a selection of his writings called The Black Agenda, which will very soon be published by Orr Books. 2 months ago, the publisher of Orr Books, Colin Robinson, and I drove out to New Jersey to visit Glenn. He had just gotten out of the hospital where they took fluid out of his cancerous lung. He was somewhat frail, but pretty chipper. We ate bagels and cream cheese at the dining room table and talked politics for 2 hours. As we left, Colin remarked that it was a shame we hadn't recorded our conversation. Glenn was that brilliant. Glenn was the real thing, a black nationalist and a socialist, as he described himself. He was a former Black Panther and usually wore a black beret when he spoke. He ended his speeches with his right arm held high in the air, saying, "Power to the people." Heidi, tell us something about his background.
Michael, for over half a century, Glenn provided a moral voice among progressive black journalists. He began his career as a radio news reporter in Georgia and later as a TV and online correspondent. Glenn's upbringing informed his lifelong ethos and vocation. His mother was an Irish-American communist and civil rights activist. And his father was a disc jockey known on air as the Deuce, who associated with singers such as James Brown, Aretha Franklin, and Jackie Wilson. Glenn and three colleagues from BlackCommentator.com left in 2006 to found, as you mentioned, the Black Agenda Report. It was run on a tight budget, and it was fiercely independent and is a highly respected news outlet. Years before, in 1977, Glenn co-founded America's Black Forum, the first nationally syndicated black news TV interview program. Dozens of local stations carried it, including WJLA, the ABC affiliate in Washington. And it brought people not often given a national platform to speak together, including Communist Party leaders and welfare rights activists. As you know, Glenn was a vocal critic of the black political leadership. That included President Barack Obama and now Senator Cory Booker. He called them out for failing to address the interests of economically disadvantaged black Americans and in their accepting money from big corporations. We will sorely miss Glenn, but on a positive note, he has left an enduring legacy, and he has set a very high bar for journalistic integrity.
We go now back to 2014 to hear the speech that Glenn Ford gave on the occasion of the 7th anniversary of Black Agenda Report.
To begin this program, which is put together around the theme of the Blackness Leadership Class, I think that two words would suffice to introduce the subject of Black Misleadership Class. And those words are Cory Booker, whose name is, of course, on everyone's lips. Just this week, of course, Cory Booker was elected, or became the senator-elect from New Jersey. Last night, I was flipping around through the channels and I stumbled, totally by mistake of course, upon Fox TV. And I saw that the crew was busy trying to explain how Cory Booker was such a liberal tax and spend politician who would favor urban areas, meaning black, over suburban areas of New Jersey, meaning white. And that is just so far from the truth, it is laughable, because Cory Booker is the politician who was bought and paid for by the same institutions, the same money bags that are just as white and far to the right as Fox News itself. In point of historical fact, Booker's political career was birthed in the womb of the right-wing Bradley Foundation out of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And you don't get any more reactionary than that. The Bradley Foundation was so far to the right and so good at doing far-right things that it was dubbed by President Bush his favorite foundation. And he wasn't kidding about that. They did him some great service. They contributed to two of his most important domestic policies. One of them was called the Faith-Based Initiative, which was essentially a scheme designed to bribe a whole class of black preachers. And black preachers are, of course, a very important component of the black misleadership class, as Dr. West would explain if he hadn't had this personal tragedy. Bush's faith-based initiative had black preachers lined up, literally thousands of them, to get a federal gift. And in return, those preachers would either become Republicans or endorse Republican policies. That was the product of the Bradley Foundation and the think tanks that it funds. The other gift that the Bradley Foundation gave to the Bush administration was the campaign for private school vouchers. And that campaign was very quickly expanded into an all-out push for charter schools, which did even more widespread destruction. And that is the point where Cory Booker comes in. Cory Booker had just turned 30, and he was in his first year of his first term in the Newark City Council, where, by the way, and I used to cover the Newark City Council for a small black newspaper that I helped found, and nobody on the city council paid much attention to Cory Booker. He was there at the first meeting, the founding gathering in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, under the auspices of the Bradley Foundation, for a front group that they had specifically formed in order to try and create the impression that there was a movement out there among black folks for private school vouchers. Now, the reality was that private school vouchers had never been an issue in the black community. If people were familiar at all with private school vouchers, it was in the context of them being used in order to fund segregation academies in the Deep South during the time of massive resistance. But the Bradley Foundation reasoned that with their millions and millions of dollars, they could create a movement or the semblance of one out of thin air. All they had to do was attract a gaggle of hustlers and scoundrels, black hustlers and scoundrels, and call them the thinkers and movers and shakers of a new movement, and it would be so. And all they had to do was tell the corporate media that this was a legitimate movement of black people, and they would cover it that way. And Cory Booker was at that first meeting of this Black Alliance of for Educational Options in 1998. Also on hand was Floyd Flake. He was the congressman from Queens who, before he resigned, was the only member of the Congressional Black Caucus who ever supported school vouchers. Floyd Flake went on to become an important cog in the wheel of the Manhattan Institute. All of you are familiar with that right-wing outfit, and to make millions as a practitioner of charter schools. Flake and Booker are part of a black misleadership class, however, one that is totally bought and paid for, created out of whole cloth by the corporate world. 3 years later, after Cory got his real political beginnings, after he put together the source of his funding, he made his first run for mayor of Newark, New Jersey. That was in 2002. He was backed with millions of dollars in campaign funds from that same universe of right-wingers that he had met through the Bradley Foundation. Even the right-wing columnist George F. Will came to Newark to support Cory Booker. This is how Cory Booker was set on the path to becoming a major black political figure as a wholly owned subsidiary of the most reactionary forces in the United States, as a pure servant of corporate power. That year was 2002. That's when we first called attention at Black Commentator. Black Commentator was the predecessor to Black Agenda Report, and that's where the core of the Black Agenda Report team came together. And back in 2002, we were the first to call attention to the great danger that was represented not just by Cory Booker, but to all of these newly empowered hustlers and scoundrels who were being funded by the corporate world. That was the first issue, in fact, of the Black Commentator, the cover story for that first issue. It was called Fruit of the Poison Tree. The core team of Black Agenda Report has actually been documenting the rise of this new cohort of black corporate politicians for more than a decade, not just the 7 years that we're celebrating tonight of Black Agenda Report. The black misleadership class is nothing new. It did not begin in 1998 or in 2002 or even with this surge of corporate funding. It has always been there. It has existed in some form as long as there has been a Black America. It is a class that sees its own personal, financial, and social interests as being synonymous with the progress of black people as a whole. This class does not seek transformation of society. It seeks only their own elevation within the existing structures. The rest of Black America, as far as they are concerned, is supposed to applaud their individual success. And we're also supposed to call that black progress, no matter what is actually happening to the masses of black people at the bottom. It is the politics of putting black faces in high places and to hell with those of us stuck at the bottom or those of us who are below the bottom in the U.S. prison gulag. This black misleadership class has always been among us, and it is the tension between these representationists, these who see only the goal of being represented, that is having a few black folks in business and in motion pictures, and maybe one day, now is the day, in the White House, but do not see the need for a transformation of society. What's new is the massive influx of national corporate money to black Democrats, That is the transformation that occurred at the turn of the 21st century, and resulting in not just Cory Booker's candidacy, but others as well. It all begins in 2002 with Cory Booker's first campaign for mayor and the corporate-funded unseating of Cynthia McKinney in Atlanta and of Earl Hilliard in Alabama. These campaigns were funded by the same people that put Cory Booker up for office the first time. Corporate money transformed the black electoral politics game, just as corporate money subverted the old line black civic and civil rights organizations and made them into willing partners with the very same Wall Street banks that were, back in 2002, beginning to target every black neighborhood in the nation with subprime mortgages. That is when that offensive began as well. Corporate America begins the 21st century with a massive money offensive in black America, and they were successful beyond their wildest dreams. They knew that they had a future star in Cory Booker, and they're so happy today. They're celebrating. Their boy is going to the Senate. But back in 2002, they were also vetting another and much more talented and much more promising front man for Capitol, and his name was Barack Obama. He was beginning his campaign for the Senate from Illinois. We at Black Agenda Report, or rather at Black Commentator when the team was there, we confronted Obama for a solid month in June of 2003, Bruce Dixon and I. We had an intense back and forth exchange with Brother Obama, which you can still read in the pages of the Black Commentator. We knew that Obama was a nightmare that was about to happen, but we did let him slide. We hoped that we could somehow avoid denouncing this up-and-coming young man that so many people found so attractive. But of course, it didn't work that way. We couldn't avoid him for long. It was Barack Obama who wound up moving forward and astonishingly, in astonishing speed, Cory Booker's and the Bradley Foundation's agenda on the privatization of public schools. And one of Obama's first acts was to expand the faith-based initiatives. So we have the Bradley Foundation's initiative living on with Obama, just as the Heritage Foundation's legacy lives on in Obamacare. Cory Booker has gone on to climb into bed with every money bag in the Silicon Valley. But Barack Obama is the commander-in-chief of global capitalism, the imperial maestro with a kill list that has everybody's name and everybody's address on it, along with all of your social and political networks and friends. And all of this has been done with a black face. The transformation in black politics over the last 10 years has been staggering. It has been absolutely breathtaking. In 2002, when George Bush asked the U.S. Congress for war powers in order to attack Iraq, only 4 members of the Congressional Black Caucus voted in favor. Our team at the Black Commentator called these 4 people the 4 eunuchs of war. Now fast forward just 9 years to 2011, in the age of Obama, fully half of the Congressional Black Caucus, 20 members, voted against a resolution that would have halted the U.S. bombing of an African nation, Libya. This is an outcome that would have been unthinkable under George Bush just a few years before. It was even more grotesque when it's remembered that while these 20 black members of Congress were voting to continue bombing Libya, President Obama's jihadist rebel friends were carrying out a race war on the ground in Libya, purging the country of black Libyans and African migrants and massacring them by the thousands. But that didn't change the minds of half of the Congressional Black Caucus. Only a decade earlier, in 2003, just 6 weeks before the Iraq war began, the Zogby poll did a survey that found that only 21% of blacks supported an attack on Iraq. Huge majorities at the same time of white men were for the war, and majorities of white women and nearly half of Hispanics were also for a war against Iraq. But when the Zogby poll asked the question, would you support an invasion of Iraq if it would result in the death of thousands of Iraqi civilians, only 7% of blacks said yes. And that was a reaffirmation of what pollsters had found consistently ever since blacks have been included in the polling process. They have found that African Americans are the group most consistently opposed to U.S. military adventures abroad. And that is because, historically, we have not trusted the motives of the United States. And we never have. That is, until a black man came to sit in the White House. And suddenly, those motives were seen as benign. Now, fast forward again to September of this year. For the first time in history, more blacks said they were in favor of war than whites did. This has never happened before. 40% of blacks surveyed by the ABC Washington Post poll, said they were in favor of a military strike against Syria. Only 38% of whites said so, and only 31% of Hispanics were in favor. The question then raised is this a repudiation by a sizable proportion of black folks of the historical black consensus on peace and on social justice? I don't think that it is a repudiation, but right now we can't prove whether it is or not. What is clear is that the age of Obama is offering up the worst role models in black American history, and the black political class that is quite willing to consign the black consensus on peace to the dustbin of history in order to defend a black presence in the highest office in the land. So go bomb the Libyans and go bomb the Syrians. We got a black man in the White House. What does it matter? A significant proportion of the black population is willing to go along with almost any program as long as they feel that they are acting or expressing opinions that are in defense of Obama. I'm going to leave you with one more horrific factoid. Fully one-third of the Black Caucus recently voted to maintain the NSA's spying program on all Americans. And to think, one-third of the caucus, people who are representing black communities that are suffering mass incarceration and have been suffering mass incarceration for the last 40 years. And we understand that the beginning of the process of mass incarceration is hyper-surveillance of the black community. And yet this one-third of the black caucus votes for hyper-surveillance of all Americans. This is a monstrous deformity of black politics, and has occurred over just the last 10 years. It's rooted in the huge onslaught of corporate money into black democratic politics, and in the suborning by corporations of traditional black organizations. There is no movement to act as a countervailing force to the power of capital. And when there is no mass movement, the self-serving black misleadership class becomes even more influential internally in black America. Black Agenda Report exists to play a role in the rebuilding of a mass black movement. And if there is no rebuilding of a mass black movement, there is little hope of any effective progressive resistance to the rule of Wall Street and its servants in government and for peace. Some of you may say, Glenn, why all this lamentation? I thought this was supposed to be a celebration of Black Agenda's 7th anniversary, and you ain't smiled yet. But I think that we are celebrating. We're celebrating the fact that we are still here fighting the power every day. And that more and more people of all races are recognizing the real dimensions of the crisis and the character and nature of the crisis. We're celebrating the fact that there still exists a critical mass of people who are struggling to reestablish and repair the black historical consensus for social justice and peace. And some of the most outstanding personalities in that struggle are right here with us tonight. We promise you a productive and worthwhile evening. Power to the people.
That was Glenn Ford speaking at the Black Agenda Report 7th Anniversary, Riverside Church.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
The Chinese word for crisis consists of two characters. One means danger, the other means opportunity. We currently are in an historically unprecedented situation fraught with both danger and opportunity. The great Russian revolutionary Vladimir Lenin once remarked that sometimes nothing happens in decades, and other times decades happen in a few weeks. This is our situation now. We see an American spring unfolding. The public lynching of George Floyd has triggered massive outpourings in several thousands of American cities, both large and small. Black Lives Matter is supported by a majority of Americans, including a majority of whites. This kind of broad solidarity was absent during the time of Martin Luther King. The demonstrations are in large part led by people of color, mostly young people. Elected officials and traditional civil rights leaders are not leading the current uprising. As the LA Progressive has written, the gross underlying inequality, racially and more broadly economically, affects every aspect of life in the U.S. and is the root cause of the volcanic anger erupting against the veneer of obsolete institutions. We speak today with Glenn Ford, the editor of the prestigious Black Agenda Report, about the unfolding movement, where it came from, and where it might be heading. Ford founded the Black Agenda Report and has edited it since 2006. He was a founding member of the Washington chapter of the National Association of Black Journalists, and he has spoken at scores of colleges and universities. Glenn Ford, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Oh, thanks for inviting me.
Let's talk about the position of many politicians that police reforms, like wearing of body cameras or more training, or the outlawing of chokeholds, that this will curb police abuse. What's your view on these reforms? Will they really curb police abuse?
Well, of course, we all are in favor, in principle, with most of those reforms. But understand what these politicians are doing is protecting the police, protecting them by getting rid of those behaviors and policies that have come under the greatest attack. But they're not going to be cooperative in any demand for reallocation of power, that is, to make the police truly accountable. They use that word all the time, accountability, but accountability is a power relationship, and that they don't want to tamper with.
So how do you appreciate the demand to abolish the police? Angela Davis has articulated that. Critics respond that we'll be unsafe if we abolish the police. Would we?
Well, we don't just abolish the police. We replace the police. And in the interim, between the actual physical replacement of the police, you exercise decisive power over not just what they do day to day, that is, overseeing them to see that they don't commit excessive infractions, which is what oversight seems to be these days, but you shape what policing is in America. That means, in fact, that most of the cops who presently are on the job have been mistrained, have joined the police force for all the worst reasons, and will have to be replaced. So this is a huge undertaking that requires real, not just community input, but community mobilization for the power to reshape the police so that we don't even call them police anymore. It requires that the people take part in their own security. That is a tremendous popular mobilization project that has to go along with the demands. So no, you don't just get rid of the police overnight. There would be a huge backlash if that ever happened, and it won't. But if it ever did, there'd be a huge backlash from the black community itself, because the security problem, and everyone has security concerns all over the world, the security question would not be addressed. But we must address that security question. And so it's fine and necessary to state the principle and the long-range goal of disbanding the police, but that demand itself calls forth a whole arena of work and study to find out what kind of work we should be doing. The project cries out to be filled out.
So what's the role, I mean the real role, apart from they say that they're keeping us safe, I don't believe that. What's the real role of the police in our class society?
Oh, it's the protection of property and privilege. And in a racist society, that means white property, oligarchs' property, and white privilege. That has been their function the entire time. They have not stepped away from that imperative. In fact, they've doubled down, which is what militarization of the police, federal intervention in policing, which was always marketed as a kind of reform. People had it in their heads, and they were encouraged to think that this kind of reform would get rid of, make passe and obsolete the Dodge Sheriff figure, you know, the pot-bellied Dodge Sheriff, Southern, of course, who lorded it over black folks and called on his good old boys to help to reinforce him if they thought black folks got out of line. Everybody wanted to get rid of that. But the real result of federal intervention beginning in 1968 with the passage of the LEAA, the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration Bill, federal intervention and all the rest that have followed under the mass black incarceration regime have in fact made the imperative of keeping black folks in line, protecting white privilege and property even more intense, more fatal, much more like a police state. In fact, when you talk about the United States, it's not like a police state. It is the archetype of a police state in the modern capitalist world.
So how would you ensure public safety if the police are abolished?
Well, just as the Black Panther Party proposed back in 68-69, the people should police themselves or choose the instruments of their own security. That is a self-determination question. It's a question of democracy. And the immediate answer in today to that question is community control of police. And in Chicago, they have by far the most developed community control of police campaign in the whole country. They've had a bill for community control of the police since 2012, I believe, and through some wonderful redirection of street protest power into an intervention in the electoral system. Now in Chicago, 19 of the 50 city councilmen, board of aldermen, now support community control of the police. The mayor, the new black woman mayor, of course, is a longtime friend and supporter of the Chicago police. And she's the biggest impediment at the moment. So people ought to be looking at what's been happening in Chicago. They've been wrestling with this question for a very, very long time, inspired by the police state murder of Fred Hampton. The best analysis can be found there.
The mayor promised when she was running for office that she would be active in doing this, and yet she's not done a thing, not a single thing. Meanwhile, they've got a bill up in front of city council to provide for an elected community group that would monitor the police. I mean, that would be real community control of the police. So we'll see how that fares. Are you aware of what they're doing with that bill, Glenn?
Sure. That's the CPAC bill. That's the current iteration of the bill that was put together, as I said, back in 2012, and they've been pushing it ever since. What the mayor says, as she retreated from her campaign position, she now says that defunding of the police, that's not community control, but that defunding of the police is a bad thing because it would result in the laying off of minority police. who have less seniority. She's hiding behind the color issue in order, in fact, to protect the police.
Yeah, it reminds me of the saying that if you got a boot on your neck, it doesn't matter whether there's a brown foot inside of the boot.
If the police are an army of occupation in the black community, the color of the soldiers in that army is not really that important. What's important is the mission of that army of occupation, and that mission is to terrorize, pacify, and contain all of the black community. And that is, in fact, the general principle of the mass black incarceration regime that was imposed in the late 60s as a reaction to the black rebellions of that decade.
What is the position, Glenn Ford, of the Democratic Party respecting police abuse? I read recently that Joe Biden suggested that people be shot in the legs rather than in the chest.
Mass black incarceration, the creation of a militarized police state has always been a thoroughly bipartisan affair. With the imposition of the mass black incarceration regime, first with measures that came under the umbrella of the drug war back in 68-69. Well, the LEAA, which I explained earlier, was key to that, and that was introduced under the Johnson administration. The Crime Bill of 1994 was, of course, a creation of the Bill Clinton administration, an administration in which Joe Biden was deeply involved, and he claims, I don't know if it's really true, but he claims that he wrote the bill. So this is a bipartisan scheme to continue the containment and terrorization of and criminalization of the black community, and Joe Biden's hands are bloodier than most.
Malik Mia has written in Green Left Weekly that the demand to abolish the current police force is step one. Community control, independent prosecutors, and the creation of a safety force must follow to revolutionize policing. Can you elaborate on that, please?
No, that's a little bit backwards, and activists can argue about it. But, of course, it's backwards. You're not going to abolish a police department and then get community control. It really doesn't work that way. As others have pointed out, if there is a vacuum under capitalism in security for property, then the people with property are going to buy their security. If the public's not going to provide the policing that the oligarchs want, then the oligarchs and even white neighborhood associations will then contract with private security firms. And we know this will occur. We saw it in New Orleans with Katrina. As soon as there was no effective police because the police were either stranded or had left town themselves, then we saw this huge influx of private security firms, including not just Blackwater, the villainous mercenary outfit based in the U.S., but Israeli security firms, all of them descending on New Orleans. You would have that kind of situation if you willy-nilly disbanded before establishing black community control or community control. That's what you'd see. But that's not going to happen. If it did happen, however, you'd have almost the worst of all possible worlds with these private mercenaries now stalking and acting in predatory fashion in the black community.
Elected officials and traditional civil rights leaders are not leading the current uprising. New young leaders, many of them people of color, have stepped up. How do you appreciate that phenomena?
Well, almost all the elected leaders of the black community are, of course, Democrats, and they take their orders from the Democratic Party and from Nancy Pelosi. So we saw the farcical spectacle of Nancy Pelosi surrounded by her minions in the Congressional Black Caucus, putting on kente cloth and taking a knee in the Capitol grounds in some kind of symbolic act of solidarity. But we have to talk about who that was surrounding Nancy Pelosi. In 2014, 2 months before Michael Brown was shot down in Ferguson, Missouri, the Grayson Amendment was on the House floor. The Grayson Amendment would have halted, abolished the Pentagon's 1033 program. The 1033 program is the federal program, the main one, for militarization of the police. It funnels billions of dollars in military weapons and gear and sometimes training to local police departments. And it was up for a vote. In that vote, 30 members of the Congressional Black Caucus voted to keep the 1033 program going. Only 8 voted against it. That means 80% of the Congressional Black Caucus voted to continue the militarization of the police. That included William Clay, who was Michael Brown's congressman, Michael Brown being the young man shot down in Ferguson, Missouri in August of 2014, setting off what came to be called the Black Lives Matter movement. But those same Congressional Black Caucus members, having gone through the first iteration of the Black Lives Matter movement, seem to have learned nothing, nothing at all. It was as if the movement never existed, because in 2018, 75% of the Congressional Black Caucus voted to make the police a protected class. That is, protected like people of color are protected under the law, and voted an assault against police should be a federal hate crime. Of course, you know, everybody knows that when the police kick your butt, they always charge you with assault. So now you'll be eligible for another 5 years in prison for committing a federal hate crime because the cops charged you with assault. But this is what that Congressional Black Caucus does, and they have the nerve to bend a knee and kneel along with their boss lady as if they are in solidarity with any movement against the police.
You're listening to Law and Disorder Radio. Our guest today is Glenn Ford, the founder and editor of Black Agenda Report. The Democrats in both the House and the Senate oppose the demand to defund or especially abolish the police. They place their hopes in electing Joe Biden. What would that mean for Black Lives Matter if Joe Biden is elected?
Oh, you know, people speculate. The left speculates about this all the time, whether it's better for the movement if a right-wing racist Republican is in power or if a Democrat is in power. And lots of my friends say that, well, it's better when Democrats are in power because then they have to face up to and defend the status quo rather than when they're out of power, pretend that they're not defenders of the status quo. I really don't like to engage in that kind of speculation because usually it's engaged in as an excuse to drop everything and vote for the Democrat, whoever that is, and I see no value in getting involved in that.
Do you think that the movement should focus on the election, or do you believe that social change comes from someplace else, from below?
Well, we already saw that it comes from somewhere else, from below. We had hundreds of thousands of people in the streets in the George Floyd protests. Those protests and occupations still continue. And we saw the reaction of the ruling class. You can see what the ruling class's reaction is through the reaction of their media. That's the ruling class media. And through the reaction of the corporate duopoly. And so they all basically folded or pretended to fold to these demands, but not in substance. That is, they conceded that police brutality, yes, does exist, that it is directed disproportionately at Black people, and that the problem is systemic. That they have finally accepted. In fact, it's now part of their regular spiel, and they've enlisted all their corporate people, and they're giving lots of money to Black Lives Matter and all kinds of other organizations in order to pretend that they're down with systemic change. But what they're really trying to do, of course, is to blunt the change, to say we have been now convinced now by you that there is a problem, therefore you can leave it up to us to solve. By doing that, they hope to blunt any empowerment demands, which is what the next order of the day, like community control of police. They want you to leave the solution in their hands because they've been converted. They're born again. They're on your side.
We're speaking with Glenn Ford of Black Agenda Report. Glenn, social consciousness and confidence, especially among youth, is growing. Participation in the mass movement has caused that. Beyond police abolition, what other demands do you anticipate are going to come to the fore?
All of them will come to the fore. You know, I think, and I can't prove it, but I'm sure of it, the huge white participation, young white people especially, in this round of protests, and in fact, they numerically dominated in lots of places. You know, there were protests everywhere in the United States, including places where there were very few black people. There are only 14 Black Lives Matter chapters in the United States. Most big cities don't have one. And yet demonstrations, protests of all kinds were everywhere with the participation of huge numbers of white kids. And I think that is a direct result of Bernie Sanders being forced out or bowing out of his race for the Democratic presidential nomination. That race, beginning in 2016 and continuing this year, had raised the expectations of millions of young people of the possibility of making some kind of important changes in the United States through the electoral process. But the nonstop 24/7 beatdown that the corporate media and the Democratic Party inflicted on Bernie, resulting finally in him bowing out and scurrying over into the Biden camp and acting like we're all in this together, I think that caused millions of his young white supporters to say, no, street is where it's at. I think those kids, many of them, wanted to be in the streets even as they supported Bernie, but they didn't want to embarrass the candidate. Well, he unleashed them and freed them when he bowed out. I think that is responsible for much of the disproportionate, in terms of black-led movements, white participation.
Glenn, we've got time, unfortunately, for only two more questions. And I wanted to ask you the penultimate question. Malcolm X profoundly understood that, as he put it, you can't have capitalism without racism. Do you think more and more people are making that connection?
Yeah, and we're seeing more and more people using the term racial capitalism, as if it's one word, in fact, racial capitalism. There is a question whether capitalism, in theory, can work without racism. But that's not how capitalism developed in the United States in particular, but it applies to all of the imperial countries. The United States would not be the United States, would not have been able to produce all that capital from the super, super, super exploitation of slaves and become, before the turn of the 20th century, a major world economic power. In 1850, 10 years before the Civil War, the value, market value of slaves was the biggest asset of the United States, bigger than every other asset, all the railroads, all the industries, everything else except the land of the United States itself. And that the land of those slave states was, in fact, overvalued. It was valuable only because it was worked by slaves. So this capitalism has always been racial, and Britain would not be the position of of the center of world capital until overtaken by the United States, except for its super exploitation, people in India and Africa and elsewhere in the world. So capitalism's always been racial, and it's only theoretical whether it could exist otherwise.
Glenn, how can people contact Black Agenda Report and follow your work?
Well, they can go to Black Agenda Report easily and see a new issue every Wednesday by visiting blackagendareport.com. But all of our editors, me included, we all list our email addresses at the bottom of each story that we write. So you can also contact us directly.
Thanks, Glenn. One last question before we have to say goodbye. People will be listening to this program the week of the 4th of July. And my last question for you is, what does the 4th of July mean to you?
Oh, you know, you made an easy one there. All you have to do, the best statement on the 4th of July ever, never to be surpassed, was Frederick Douglass's speech on what is the 4th of July to me. Delivered in, I believe, Rochester, New York, in the 1850s. It reams the United States out with the most artistic, if that's the right word, language ever employed against a villain.
He was an eloquent man. Glenn Ford, it's great to have you on Law & Disorder. Keep up your good work on Black Agenda Report, and we're sure to have you back as a guest in the near future. You take it easy, Glenn Ford, and thank you so much.
Thank you, brother. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Northern California, the death toll from the McKinney fire has risen to 4 after authorities found the remains of 2 more victims Wednesday. Slow-moving thunderstorms have slowed the spread of the blaze, which has consumed 57,000 acres, but the rain triggered local flooding and shifted concerns to the threat of mudslides. This comes as the northeastern United States is baking under a heat wave that is threatening to top records across the Northeast. In Washington, D.C., 7 U.S. veterans and their allies were arrested outside the U.S. Capitol Wednesday as they protested the military's role in driving the climate crisis. A 2017 study found the Pentagon emits more greenhouse gases than many of the world's countries, including Sweden and Portugal. On Wednesday, U.N. Secretary General Antonio Guterres slammed oil and gas company greed, saying government should tax profits made after Russia's invasion of Ukraine pushed fuel prices to new highs. Guterres said the largest fossil fuel companies earned nearly $100 billion in profits during the first quarter of this year alone.
I urge people everywhere to send a clear message to the fossil fuel industry and their financiers that this grotesque greed is punishing the poorest and most vulnerable people while destroying our only common home, the planet.
On Capitol Hill, Arizona Democratic Senator Kyrsten Sinema has signaled she wants changes to a budget reconciliation bill containing many of President Biden's legislative priorities on energy, taxes, and health care. In a private call with Arizona's Chamber of Commerce Tuesday, Sinema questioned part of the Inflation Reduction Act that would impose a 15% minimum tax on corporations. Sinema also questioned a provision to close the carried interest loophole, which taxes private equity and hedge fund managers at lower rates than most U.S. workers. Meanwhile, environmentalists are sounding the alarm over billions of dollars in new tax breaks and subsidies that oil and gas companies would receive as part of the compromise deal agreed to last week by Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin. On Wednesday, Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders said he'll offer amendments that would strip out a requirement tying new investments in green energy to mandatory lease sales of millions of acres of public lands to oil and gas companies.
In my view, if we are going to make our planet healthy and habitable for future generations, we cannot provide billions of dollars in new tax breaks to the very same fossil fuel companies that are currently destroying the planet.
The U.S. Senate has voted to add Finland and Sweden to NATO in a major expansion of the military alliance and the first since North Macedonia joined NATO in 2020. Wednesday's Senate vote was 95-1, with only Missouri Senator Josh Hawley voting no. All 30 NATO members are expected to complete the ratification of Finland and Sweden by the end of the year. Indonesia, Australia, and Japan have begun joint combat exercises with the United States on the island of Sumatra. Though the drills are held annually, these are the largest ever and come just after House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan, which China condemned as a provocation. Earlier today, China's military fired several ballistic missiles into the waters around Taiwan as it began large-scale air and naval drills near the self-governing island, which China considers part of its territory. President Biden signed an executive order to help patients seeking abortions to travel to states that still allow the procedure. Biden signed the order as Senate Republicans blocked a Democratic bill to protect abortion care providers from violent threats and attacks. Meanwhile, Georgia's Department of Revenue said this week it'll allow state residents to claim fetuses and embryos as dependents, a tax deduction worth up to $3,000. In June, a federal appeals court upheld a Georgia law defining a developing embryo as a person as soon as fetal cardiac cells begin activity, typically around 6 weeks of pregnancy. In Indiana, Republican Congress member Jackie Walorski and two members of her staff were killed in a head-on collision on Wednesday. The driver of the other car was also pronounced dead at the scene. Walorski served on the House Ways and Means Committee and was seeking re-election to a sixth term in November's midterm election. She was 58 years old. In Guanajuato, Mexico, journalist and businessman Ernesto Mendez was shot and killed Tuesday night along with two other people after gunmen stormed a liquor store he owned and opened fire. Mendez ran the online news source Your Voice, had previously reported threats. He's the 13th media worker to be killed in Mexico this year alone. In Austin, Texas, far-right conspiracy theorist and InfoWars host Alex Jones admitted from the witness stand Wednesday that the 2012 Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre in Newtown, Connecticut, was real. Jones' admission came at his civil trial, where he faces a $150 million defamation lawsuit from families of schoolchildren killed at Sandy Hook. For years, Jones spread conspiracy theories that the Newtown shooting was a government hoax and the victims' families were paid actors, resulting in online harassment and death threats for Sandy Hook families. The 2012 massacre claimed the lives of 20 schoolchildren and six educators. This week, Scarlett Lewis, whose six-year-old son, Jesse, was among the 20 children killed in the massacre, confronted Alex Jones from the witness stand.
I wanted to tell you to your face, because I wanted you to know that I am a mother, first and foremost, and I know that you're a father, and my son existed. You're still on your show today trying to say that I'm implying that I'm an actress.
This week, lawyers for the Sandy Hook families revealed Alex Jones' attorneys sent them every text message Jones sent for the past 2 years, apparently by mistake. On Wednesday, the House committee investigating the Capitol insurrection signaled it may subpoena Jones' messages as it investigates his contacts with planners of the January 6th attack. Donald Trump has welcomed Hungary's President Viktor Orban to his golf club in Bedminster, New Jersey, ahead of the Conservative Political Action Conference, or CPAC, which opens today in Dallas, Texas. Trump's scheduled to deliver closing remarks Saturday. Orban is speaking today. CPAC's warm welcome of Orban came just days after he delivered a speech in Romania that drew comparisons to Nazi rhetoric.
There is a world in which European peoples are mixed together with those arriving from outside Europe. Now that is a mixed race world. And then there's our world, where people from within Europe mix with one another.
So far, none of the prominent conservatives scheduled to share the stage with Orban at CPAC have condemned the racist remarks. That includes far-right TV personalities Sean Hannity and Glenn Beck, Senator Ted Cruz, and Congressmembers Lauren Boebert, Matt Gaetz, and Jim Jordan. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast. A top Justice Department official said Wednesday his agency has investigated more than 1,000 threats to election workers over the past year. Assistant Attorney General Kenneth Polite told the Senate Judiciary Committee Wednesday that the pace of violent threats has increased sharply since former President Trump and his backers falsely claimed the 2020 election was rigged.
Threats to the election community remain a national public safety issue requiring a national response, regardless of politics. The trauma experienced in this community is profound and unprecedented.
The warning came a day after Trump-backed candidates who deny the results of the 2020 election won primary elections in Arizona and Michigan. The National Labor Relations Board has ordered a union of striking coal miners in Alabama to pay $13.3 million in damages to the Warrior Met Coal Company 16 months after they walked off the job to protest huge cuts to their pay, pensions, and health care benefits. The NLRB cited the strike's financial toll on Warrior Met's labor and security costs, as well as, quote, lost revenues for unmined coal. In a statement, the United Mine Workers of America called the NLRB's ruling a slap in the face of workers and said it has no intention of paying the fine. Union President Cecil Roberts said, quote, "Is it now the policy of the federal government that unions be required to pay a company's losses as a consequence of their members exercising their rights as working people? This is outrageous and effectively negates workers' right to strike," he said. In more news from Alabama, a subsidiary of Hyundai has been accused of using child labor at a factory that produces parts for the Korean automaker. Reuters reports underage workers, in some cases as young as 12, recently worked at a metal stamping plant operated by Smart Alabama LLC, which supplies parts to Hyundai's flagship U.S. assembly plant in nearby Montgomery. Labor advocates are sounding the alarm over a bipartisan House bill that would gut protections for workers in the gig economy. The Worker Flexibility and Choice Act would amend the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938 to end minimum wage and overtime protections for workers at companies like DoorDash, Uber, and Lyft. The National Employment Law Project warns the bill would, quote, radically erode fundamental worker protections in the United States to the benefit of big corporations, allowing them to require workers to sign away basic rights as a condition of work, unquote. The bill is co-sponsored by two House Republicans and Democratic Congressmember Henry Cuellar of Texas. In May, Cuellar defeated progressive primary challenger Jessica Cisneros by under 300 votes. After winning the endorsement of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Democratic Majority Whip James Clyburn, who joined Cuellar on the campaign trail. And radical activist and longtime member of the Catholic worker movement, Tom Cornell, died August 1st at the age of 88. Cornell, who blended traditional Catholicism with radical activism, used his actions and writings for bringing Christian nonviolence and war resistance to the forefront of Catholic life. Cornell worked closely with Catholic worker founder Dorothy Day and was a co-founder of Pax Christi USA. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Democracy Now! Co-host Nermeen Sheikh. Hi, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Okay, this is a clip from Democracy Now! Earlier this week, which features some of the members of the Weather Underground and their children.
Today we spend the hour with an activist who replaced Angela Davis on the FBI's 10 most wanted list, Bernadine Dorn, leader of the radical 60s and 70s organization called the Weather Underground. It was 50 years ago this year that they bombed the Pentagon to protest the Vietnam War. They also battled with police during days of rage on the streets of Chicago and partnered with black liberation groups to rob banks. When Bernadine Dorn and her fellow Weather Underground activist husband Bill Ayers literally went underground to avoid arrest, they then raised a family as they continued to fight for revolution. Now a new podcast series explores their family history. It's produced by their son, Zaid Ayers Dorn. This is a trailer for Mother Country Radicals.
In 1970, a 28-year-old recent law school graduate became the most wanted woman in America.
Angela Davis was replaced on the FBI's 10 most wanted list this afternoon by Bernadine Ray Dorn, described as an underground leader of the Weathermen.
They said she was an enemy of the state.
Within the next 14 days, we will attack a symbol or institution of American injustice.
A homegrown terrorist.
A bomb exploded early this morning in the Pentagon.
J. Edgar Hoover called her the most dangerous woman in America.
I'm going to read a declaration of a state of war.
She's also my mother.
The Mother Country Radicals podcast series was created, written, and hosted by Zaid Ayers Dorn for Crooked Media and Audacity and features interviews with his parents, Bernadine Dorn and Bill Ayers, as well as other former Weather Underground leaders who were captured and went to prison, like the late Kathy Boudin, who's mother of former San Francisco District Attorney Chesa Boudin, who then became a brother to Zaid, raised by Ayers and Dorn. Zaid also speaks to Kukuya Shakur, daughter of Asada Shakur, who still lives in exile in Cuba. We'll hear from both later. After resurfacing, Bernadine Dorn became the founding director of the Children and Family Justice Center at Northwestern University School of Law. Bill Ayers is now a retired professor in the College of Education at the University of Illinois, Chicago. The final installment of the 10-part Mother Country Radical series is just out. Today we bring you our interview with Zaid and his parents about the series, which premiered last month. I spoke with them, along with Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez. We begin with one of the many archival clips featured in Mother Country Radicals.
In May 1970, Los Angeles radio station KPFK received an anonymous phone call, leading them to a cassette tape hidden in a public phone booth. It begins like this.
Hello, this is Brandine Dorn. I'm going to read a declaration of a state of war. This is the first communication from the Weatherman Underground.
Bernadine Dorn is my mother. She's recording this tape when she's just 28 years old, surrounded by a few friends in a safe house in San Francisco, a one-room apartment they've rented using a fake ID. The place is crowded, and most of the people in the room are even younger than she is, student activists and grad school dropouts in their early to mid-20s. There's a device the size of a lunchbox set up in the middle of a table, an old-school tape cassette player with a red record button.
All over the world, people fighting American imperialism look to America's youth to use our strategic position behind enemy lines to join forces in the destruction of the empire. Kids know the lines are drawn. Revolution is touching all of our lives.
So Zaid Ayers Dorn, can you take it from there? We have just listened to the voice of Bernadine Dorn on Pacifica radio station KPFK in Los Angeles. Describe how that cassette got on the air.
Yeah, well, the Weather Underground had just gone underground and was, deciding what to do next. My mom recorded that tape, sent it to radio stations, basically announcing that they were about to launch a bombing campaign against the U.S. government in protest of the war in Vietnam and in protest of police violence against black people here in America. And so, what the show does is goes back from that moment and tells the story of how my mom was radicalized, what took her from being a law student and a straight-A student at the University of Chicago all the way to being on the FBI's top 10 wanted list, and her friends and comrades and how they all got to that point as well.
And Zaid, could you tell us what drove you to decide to do this podcast? It's an amazing series of shows. Could you talk about the motivation and why at this particular time?
Yeah, thanks, Juan. Yeah, there were really two motivations. One was political and one was personal. The political motivation was I started it right before the pandemic began when Trump was president. I was thinking about the history of resistance in America and how young people had come together at various times in our history to resist fascism and white supremacy and authoritarianism. And as I went along, George Floyd was murdered and we had this racial uprising on the street. And as that was happening, I was interviewing my parents and other folks, people in the Black Panther Party, people in the Black Liberation Army. And I was learning that so many of them were radicalized by violence from police against black people here in America. So the death of Fred Hampton, the killing of a 10-year-old boy named Clifford Glover in Queens, those were seminal events for so many of these radicals in the 70s. And I started to realize there's this kind of interesting echo happening today. That was the political motivation. The personal motivation was, we were separated by the pandemic. I was missing my parents, and I was also thinking, they were getting older. My mom was about to turn 80, and I was thinking about wanting to ask them questions I'd never asked, wanting to get their voices on tape for my daughters and for future generations. And just wanting to kind of have an archive of what they did, how they thought, and what made them who they are today.
Well, and I'd like to welcome Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn, both former comrades of mine with Students for a Democratic Society decades ago. I wanted to ask Bill, the title Mother Country Radicals, can you talk about the origin and the meaning of that phrase?
Yeah, I think that it's a great title for this series because what Zaid found as he was going through the archives and listening to people is that this was the title kind of given to us, white radicals at the time, by the Black Panther Party, by Fred Hampton, by Huey P. Newton. And they said they weren't interested in allies. They were interested in comrades. They wanted to think of us not as people who were helping the struggle, but people who were invested ourselves in the end of white supremacy, in fighting against police violence and empire. And so they always referred to us as their comrades, their mother country radicals. And That's what we took on, and I think Zaid took that as a starting point for thinking about the coming together of the Weather Underground and the Black Liberation Army.
I want to get Zaid's comment on this, but first go to Fred Hampton himself, the Black Panther leader in Chicago, before he was assassinated by the Chicago police, but speaking that same year in 1969.
A lot of people don't understand the Black Panther Party's relationship with white mother country radicals. A lot of people don't even understand that word that it refuses a lot. But what we're saying is that there are white people in the mother country that are for the same type of thing that we are for, stimulating revolution in the mother country. And we said that we work with anybody, form coalition with anybody that has revolution on their mind.
Zaid Ayers-Dorn, talk about your choice of this title.
Yeah, well, I really wanted to highlight what I found as I was doing this research into my family and into this history, which was this kind of remarkable moment when white radicals, black radicals, people of all colors were coming together to try to resist the American government, white supremacy, imperialism abroad. You know, Fred Hampton was involved right before his death in trying to put together what he called a rainbow coalition of activist groups here in Chicago. And my mom was running SDS at the time. They were part of that rainbow coalition. So there was this effort to bring these groups together. And then, of course, Fred was murdered by the Chicago police. And so part of the series is about trying to understand how white radicals and black radicals collaborated, how that was complicated, how it was messy, and what kind of lessons we can learn today from that effort.
Let's go to the remarkable archival footage that is in Mother Country Radicals of Fred Hampton's assassination.
About 10 Panthers went to the Monroe Street address and had dinner and Kool-Aid before they went to sleep.
Fred is supposed to stay at his mom's house that night, but it's late. He goes in the bedroom with his fiancée, Deborah Johnson. She's 8 months pregnant with Fred's child.
Still half asleep. I looked up, and I saw bullets coming from, it looked like, the front of the apartment, from the kitchen area. They were, pigs were just shooting.
She later remembered that night. This is after she gave birth, and she's cradling her baby, Fred Jr. You can hear him cooing in the background.
The mattress is just going. You could feel bullets going into it. I just knew dead, everybody in there. When he looked up, just looked up, he didn't say a word, and he didn't move, except for moving his head up. He laid his head back down. He never said a word, and he never got up out the bed. A person was in the room. They kept hollering out, "Stop shooting, stop shooting. We have a pregnant woman, a pregnant sister in here." Pigs kept on shooting. So he kept on hollering out. Finally, they stopped. They pushed me and the other brother by the kitchen door and told us to face the wall. Heard a pig say, "He's barely alive, he'll barely make it." So then they started shooting the pig. They started shooting up, shooting again. I heard a sister scream. They stopped shooting. Pig said, "He's good and dead now."
And through all the gunfire, all the screaming, Fred Hampton never wakes up. The autopsy shows secobarbital, a sedative in his system. William O'Neill, the Panther who made the Kool-Aid that night, turns out he's also an FBI informant. Fred had apparently been drugged on the orders of federal law enforcement and assassinated by the Chicago police.
It was December 4th, 1969, and somehow I remember seeing footage, Bernadine, of you walking into the house. This was it the same day after he was assassinated? Was it a day later? But if you can talk about who Frampton was and how that assassination even further radicalized you, what it meant for the movement in this country and for the Weather Underground.
Well, Amy, I remember everyone my age who was around remembers where they were the day that Fred Hampton was assassinated and Mark Clark. His colleague, and you know, it seared into our head because it was people we knew, because it was the city of Chicago, because the Red Squad and the sheriffs and the police all collaborated with the FBI. We took 6 years to bring them to trial and prove it. The People's Law Office did an incredible job doing that. But I remember one of the things that they did was they immediately went and took the door off of its hinges and invited the city of Chicago to walk into that apartment building and look at what the police and the FBI had done in the process of murdering black radical revolutionary leaders like Fred Hampton and Mark Clark. So, yes, I went that day, as many of us did. It was reminiscent of other Chicago massacres and kind of mass participation and observing not the body in this case, but the site. So it had a Chicago feel about it, and it was a somber and terrible moment where we felt, you know, we must act, we must do more than we've been doing, we must do more than the kind of solidarity that we've offered. And we used to talk about it as putting our bodies between the bullets and the black radical leadership in the United States.
And Zaid, I want to ask you, some of the people, I mean, many of the people that you interviewed, I knew personally back then, folks like Kathy Boudin, Kathy Wilkerson, Eleanor Stein, Jeff Jones, Jennifer Dorn, and Brian Flanagan, who was a good friend of mine back years ago. What did you take away from their assessment of their role back then in the movement, and whether it's bitterness, pride, contrition? What did you get from your interviews with them?
Yeah, well, it was really interesting. Well, it's funny because one, the names you mentioned are all members of the Weather Underground. I also interviewed Angela Davis, Jamal Joseph, Jihad Abdul-Mumit, Sekou Odinga, members of the Black Panther Party and the Black Liberation Army. So, and what I took away from all of them, you know, I was talking to a lot of them about how they had first become radicalized, and I kept hearing these echoes, white radicals and black radicals, over and over, radicalized by state violence against black leaders. So many of them, you know, the Martin Luther King's assassination, Fred Hampton's assassination, other killings of black people by police. So one thing is they were all kind of telling me the same story about how they came to fight that struggle. And then in terms of how they look back on it, I would say, I mean, the series talks a lot about that. And later in the series, I get into regrets and questions of tactics and what they would do differently now. And I think the common denominator is that there's a lot of acknowledgement of mistakes made, but there's also a lot of sense of we were on the right side of history, we were struggling on the right side, and it's hard to regret the kind of willingness to put yourself, put your future, put your body on the line for what you believe if you feel like what you believe is right.
I want to go back to Country Radicals. In episode one, Zaid, you begin to unpack some of the conflicts that arose between predominantly white activists like those in Students for a Democratic Society, the larger group from which members splintered off to form Weather Underground, and black activists like those in the Black Panthers and later the Black Liberation Army. Let's first turn to Bernadine Dorn in Mother Country Radicals.
Whenever white people have a choice, you can't make that choice without thinking about how easy it is to not stand up for black people at a given moment. I never felt like I wasn't choosing women, but I felt that, you know, the essential American dilemma is white people standing up not just once, but consistently over time against the apparatus of black slavery.
And this is Angela Davis.
She knew exactly how to make those connections long before the term intersectionality had ever been introduced, at a time when we hadn't yet developed the vocabulary that allowed us to talk about gender issues in an intersectional way. I read some of her communiques, and my reaction was always, you know, right on.
That's Angela Davis actually speaking about Bernadine. And Bernadine, I want to go to you next because Angela Davis was on the FBI Most Wanted list. You replaced her on that list. I want to go back to that time. I mean, this is the FBI of J. Edgar Hoover. And for those who aren't familiar with this history, talk about how you got involved with SDS. And then how you got involved with the Weather Underground, became the leader of the Weather Underground.
Well, you know, it's astonishing, what can I say, there's no such thing as replacing Angela Davis on any list or on anything. She's a colleague and a comrade and a sister and a friend. But I think her pointing out that we didn't have language back in 1969, 70, 71, 72, about not just language, but the connective tissue of the word intersectionality, so that you didn't have to choose between being a woman and being against the war in Vietnam. That was insane, and yet the politics of the time made that often true on the ground. So her whole life and her whole career helping to make that manifest for Black Lives Matter and undocumented and unafraid and activists of today is quite dramatic. And you can see their wisdom and their ability to fight for unity at the same time as they have disagreements and move in different ways. You know, I'm filled with admiration for this generation of activists and awe, really, and trying to tag along and keep up with them on the streets.
Now, Bernadine, by the way, happy birthday. You've recently turned 80 years old. Now, interestingly, back decades ago, you were one of the older members of the student movement and one of the older leaders. You actually were in law school. Talk about what radicalized you at that time and then joining SDS, and then why you formed with Bill Ayers and others the Weather Underground.
You know, I always felt that I had been a wimp, and by my failure to go south with SNCC and the Southern Civil Rights Movement. I thought about it. I didn't know anybody connected to it. I wanted to go, you know, my boyfriend talked me out of wanting to go, and it was ridiculous. So when the Civil Rights Movement, Dr. King and all the allies around him came to Chicago, I was a second-year law student, and I was like, this is it. I have to now put myself in this struggle here in Chicago, and if possible with him. And I took a bunch of law students to meet with Dr. King. He, of course, as he always did, had tons of law firms and lawyers around him and willing to help and organize. And he said to me, we said we'd like to do something. He said, find the biggest slumlord in Chicago. Identify and give me the evidence for who the biggest slumlord is in Chicago. We ran back to the law school, the group of us from the University of Chicago Law School. We went to the law librarians, who we felt were the people who would help us, not so much the faculty. And we spent a week looking at records and going through, films, and we couldn't find anything that would identify slumlords. We went back to Dr. King the next weekend. Ashamed, he did turn to me and say, what did you find? We said, we can't identify it because of this, this, and this. And he said, that's fine. We'll call a citywide rent strike. And we were moved on the agenda about how to organize a citywide rent strike. So it was, for me, it's an example of how if you just take a step toward the movement, toward somebody you admire, toward somebody who's organizing a campaign around you, you will stay yourself, but you will be changed by it, and you will grow from it. And I think that's still true today.
And Bill, a central tension in the podcast is the balance between your lives as activists,
And that as parents, as, could you talk about that? Maybe Zahid could chime in as well in terms of what he tried to do with the podcast.
You want me to start? Yeah, I mean, for me, the personal entry into the story is obviously these are my parents. I grew up, you know, when I was born, they were underground. They were on the run from the FBI. And so I grew up my first few years in this kind of strange situation of being underground, of knowing that we were underground, knowing that the FBI was chasing us, even though I'm not sure I knew what the FBI was. And, you know, so when I started working on this project, a lot of it was me thinking, I have two daughters now, and I was trying to imagine, you know, what kind of commitment would make people ready to, you know, have children when they were fugitives. I mean, to balance that idea. I mean, they were great parents, and yet there was this tension or this risk associated with, you know, having kids when you're also fighting a armed revolution against the state. And, you know, my mom went to jail when I was a kid. My adopted brother, Chesa, his parents both went to prison for decades. And so a lot of the show, and later on in the podcast, in episodes 9 and 10, a lot of it ends up being about my peers, you know, myself, Chesa Boudin, my adopted brother, Kakuya Shakur, who is Asada Shakur's daughter. And Asada, of course, is still underground in Cuba. And so talking to Chesa and Kakuya about what it was like to be kids born into the revolution really informs a lot of the show and a lot of the kind of sense of what the questions I'm asking about how can you balance family with the struggle.
And you know, I think that one of Zaid's kids asked me the other day, when you had kids, did that change your politics? And you know, and she was referring to her father. And,
And
she's 14 years old.
Yeah.
And I said to her that I thought that it certainly didn't make me change my politics, but it did make me think twice about the kinds of risks I was willing to take and wanted to take. I had a particular responsibility to this child, to Malik, the next child, and to Chesa. We had a particular responsibility to them. We also couldn't lose sight of the fact that other people's children were under attack in Vietnam, in the United States, and we couldn't, in Puerto Rico, and we couldn't just let that go. And I don't think that contradiction is any different than the contradictions faced by revolutionaries and radicals around the world through all time. So you talk a little bit about, you know, what about Martin Luther King or Malcolm X?
Fred Hampton had a son, so, you know.
Fred Hampton or, you know, the Haymarket folks. I mean, you refer to all of them.
There's a picture, I don't know if it's in this, of Zaid on his changing table, or I think it just was a table in our house at the time. And, you know, I had a picture of Ho Chi Minh right next to him, and who else?
Che Guevara.
Che Guevara. Mm-hmm. And, but also, you know, Zaid was Robin Hood for several years at Halloween time.
Mm-hmm.
And for him, the Sheriff of Nottingham, you know, characterized a lot of the evil that we were seeing from our own government. So, yeah, we tried to make it integrated with our life once we had children.
Well, I want to go to an exchange in Episode 9 of Mother Country Radicals between you, Zaid, and your father, Bill Ayers.
Did you ever take part in actions after I was born while you were still underground?
I was involved in a few things, and one of them was, in fact, a jailbreak. And I can't tell you any of the details except to say that we were pretty clear that Bernadine would be with you and that I would do this, and then we would assess it after the fact. But it was, in retrospect, really risky and really on the edge.
Mm-hmm. This was new information for me. Before I started working on this project, I was always told that my parents' part in the armed struggle ended with my birth. But I can't say I'm exactly surprised. I've always known they were willing to risk almost anything to do what they thought was right. Did you think about what would happen if you were caught?
Yeah, I thought my life would end.
So why?
Because it mattered. Because the world needed it to happen.
Bill Ayers and Zaid Ayers-Dorn So let's talk about this issue of violence. And Bernadine and Bill, how you felt then and how you feel today, either of you can take it. If you could talk about, I mean, there are some actions you admit involvement in and some you don't.
Well, I don't, just to be clear, except for, you know, the communiques, which I was definitely part of. But I think, it always seems odd to me to be asked about the question of violence. We live in one of the most violent countries in human history. We have military still to this day in scores of countries around the world. Imagine if some other country, Italy, had a military base in the middle of North Carolina. I mean, it's unspeakable the way one thing we take for granted, United States should we have arms and wars everywhere in the world, and on the other hand, you know, we're a sacred country. So I think telling the truth about what the cost of violence is, U.S. violence in the world, and having that feel part of us. Of course, I want to just say Democracy Now! With you, Amy, and you, Juan, has always covered U.S. wars abroad and done really a remarkable job of making that part of what we have to think about every day and the concrete nature of that and who pays the heaviest prices. So, but the illusion of the United States as being against violence, what can you say? You know, this last year, children killed, it's unspeakable. So we had a focus on that. We thought we saw the truth, and we thought it didn't have to be this way. We could save lives.
And I think it's still true. I think we live in a sewer of violence, and we like to think of ourselves as peaceful people. We want to think of the United States as a peaceful place, but it's just not true. It's a violent, violent society. And at the time when we were, you know, part of the Weather Underground, 6,000 people a week were being murdered by our government in Vietnam. And we were trying to rise up to stop the genocide. That was our purpose. But it always, as Bernadine said, strikes us as odd that John McCain, who was a war criminal, was not always asked, what does it feel like to be a war criminal? But we were trying to stop the war crimes, and we're always asked, you know, why were you violent? It's like asking, you know, Nat Turner, why did you rise up and kill people on the plantation? Well, wait, the whole system was violent. Rising up against it was the right thing.
I wanted to ask Bill and Bernadine about your decision to go underground and then about your decision to resurface.
Well, we went underground the day after the explosion at the townhouse.
And explain that explosion.
Pardon me?
Explain that explosion.
Well, we heard on the news, actually, I was in California, Bill was still in Michigan, and I heard on the news that there had been a gas leak explosion in New York. I thought that was probably not a gas explosion, and I took that news to be very bad news. Because I had been in New York a week before, and I knew that people were working on explosive devices. I didn't know where or what. That explosion really meant that scores of us around the country disappeared, and we had thought that it would be necessary for some people to build a clandestine operation organization. Because of government misconduct and government violence, really, against the activists. But we didn't really know how it would come about, and it came about in that chaotic way where lots of people disappeared, and then over the course of the next year, people decided to return to their lives and work, you know, in organizations, public organizations, and other people, for a variety of reasons, decided to join the underground and be part of the underground. it was a very, even after that moment, Amy and Juan, you know, over the course of the 10 years, people actually came and went. Many people left being underground after Stonewall happened because they were gay activists and they wanted to join the public movement. And similarly with other things, sometimes family matters, sometimes personal things, and sometimes wanting to be public. So there was more churning than one would think in the actual way in which it happened. And I like that part of it, that it had, you could be underground, it could be assumed that you would never talk about it, but you could go back and do public work, and eventually, of course, we all did that.
You know, the when I think about the choice to go underground, the American invasion occupation of Vietnam began in 1965. For 5 years, we opposed the war with militant actions, with letter writing, with, you know, talking to Congress people and so on. Eventually, by 1968, a majority of Americans opposed the war, and the war ground on. 6,000 people a week being murdered in Southeast Asia. And we had tried everything. And I think about the choice to go underground. We knew, or we thought by 1970, that we would have to build some clandestine capacity, not only to take the war to the war makers, but also to survive what we thought of as an impending American fascism. So we were building a clandestine organization alongside a public organization. And then the townhouse explosion happened. Three of our comrades were killed. And we all went underground in a minute. We didn't want to spend all of our time building a legal system and so on. So we were underground. And then the war in Vietnam ended in 1975 with the U.S. defeat, which was brought about by the Vietnamese Revolution itself. And we spent another couple of years, you know, thinking about coming above ground, and it took a while to persuade Bernadine because she didn't want to give the state any kind of victory. But eventually we did, and we went back to public political work, and so that was the 11 years we spent underground. Zaid was born underground. Malik was born underground.
I wanted to ask Zaid, in addition to looking at this history, your podcast, Mother Country Radicals, also tries to look forward to the future of activism. Could you tell us about what you found out about the next generation of activists?
Yeah, I mean, it's connected to this question of violence, I think, because the people who I talked to, I mean, my brother Chase Aboudin, who, you know, saw his parents, you know, when he was 1 and a half, they left him with a babysitter and went off to rob a bank with the Black Liberation Army and then never came home, spent decades in prison. And so he grew up with us kind of dealing with the consequences of that violent struggle. Or Kakuya Shakur, who I speak to later in the podcast, her mom, you know, was imprisoned and then had to flee to Cuba and is still underground 20 years, 30 years later, 40 years later. And Kakuya talks about, you know, her mom has never met her children. Asada Shakur has never met her grandchildren.
This is another clip from Mother Country Radicals. This is Kakuya Shakur, Asada Shakur's daughter.
This might be an impossible question, or maybe it's not, maybe it's an easy question, but it's a big question. Do you think it was worth it, what your mom tried to do and what your family went through for it?
Yeah, that's a deep question, right? I felt deeply loved by my mom, but I knew that struggle, you know, was more important in the broader context. So many different points in our history, it's like we had no choice but to, you know, to struggle, to resist, and unfortunately, loss was a part of that. All the struggles that came before are contributing to us being in this moment now. Every act that happens then creates another act. I can almost feel that my life is a result of all of these experiences, the atrocities, the trauma, the struggle, the joy as well. I'm a result of all of that.
These are all young people who had to live with the consequences of that violent struggle, and yet most of the people I talk to of my generation are still committed in some way to that struggle for a better world. So Chesa, of course, became a public defender and then the district attorney of San Francisco. Kikuyo Shakur is working as a social worker here in Chicago. So I think a lot of them grapple, and I talk to them on the show about this, they grapple with, you know, what does it mean to try to change the world? How far should we go? And also they're very aware of kind of what it can look like when people decide to go down the path of revolutionary violence, what that does to families, what that does to individuals. And so I think it's a complicated question, and I try to wrestle in the show with that complexity.
I want to go to another clip of Mother Country Radicals as you raise Kathy Boudin, who just recently died of cancer, the former Weather Underground member. She was jailed in 1981, along with her then husband, David Gilbert, in connection with the armed car robbery carried out by the Black Liberation Army in Rockland County, New York, that left a security guard and two police officers dead. She would serve 22 years in prison. And as you mentioned, Chesa, their son, Chesa Boudin, he went on to be elected the district attorney of San Francisco and was recently recalled. In this clip, Kathy Boudin talks about being Chesa's mother.
I was determined to not have being a mother stop me from also being a revolutionary, because that identity for me was so critical. And I think also in terms of men and women, I felt like I wasn't going to have me as a woman not be able to go do something and have David be able to go. And that, you know, relegated me to a role of a mother, which I felt like was something that I wanted as part of who I was, but I didn't want it to take away from me the other things that I wanted to be and could do.
So that's Kathy Boudin. She also talks about how Bernadine and Bill, Bernadine Dorn and Bill Ayers, our guest today, ended up adopting their son Chesa while Kathy and her husband David Gilbert were imprisoned.
He had no idea who I was. I mean, he didn't look at me. He didn't pay attention to me. Of course, Chesa, as he began to speak, called Bernadine Mom. And I was like, oh, God, you know.
And this is an important part of the story, too. The collateral damage to the next generation, the children of the victims of the Brinks robbery, and the children of the people who committed the crime. Because none of those kids chose to be part of the revolution. They, we, were born into it and still had to suffer the consequences.
That's Zaid Ayers Dorn narrating this incredible series. Bill and Bernadine, if you can talk about how you ended up adopting Chesa, you know, having Chesa, adding to your family of Malik and Zaid, and what you saw your role was together, you not in prison, them in prison, and so many Black Panthers and members of the Black Liberation Army actually killed. Well, I'm glad you brought up Kathy's name, and I you know, of course, we're all stricken by her absence. It seems like a sudden absence, even though it was a 30-year struggle that she had against cancer. She and I had a long 2 days of conversations the week she died, and you know, part of it was just spurred by her saying we've had an incredible relationship and we really have had an incredible women's friendship and sisterhood, hard fought for, very difficult for her in the years when she was in prison and we were raising Chesa, very difficult for us to have Chesa do so many prison visits during this period of time when he was struggling with many other issues, and yet we somehow worked very hard, and her parents worked very hard, David's parents, to make it one family. You know, many families in America, because of the massive prison system, are faced with this situation of a critical family member in prison and children visiting prisons. And so it's, we were not alone, and that, I think, helped and brought Chesa into the struggle against mass incarceration. All of our children have vivid memories of getting searched and going into prison to visit Kathy in particular. And so, you know, it is part of the American story, and an odd part for us, but not really odd at all, very common. We must do away with mass incarceration. It's insane. There's a million ways to sanction illegal behavior that the rest of the world does quite successfully.
You know, we had two little kids when Kathy and David were arrested. We had not met Chaza, but Bernadine and I was working in a daycare center in Manhattan. Bernadine and I had one conversation. We took a long walk around the block, and we said, if something were to happen to us, what would our friends, what would our family, what would our comrades do? And without much thought, we said, we're going to take him. And we went and talked to his grandparents where he was living just a few days later, and he came to live with us right away. And it changed the dynamic of the family, and it was enriching in the long run and very powerful. And so we have no regrets on that regard. Zaid just said, kids have to suffer the consequences, and that's true, but that's also universally true. Imagine Ted Cruz's kids. They have to suffer the consequences of having Ted Cruz for a father. So everybody gets the family they get, and you roll with it from there, and we tried to roll with it with love and compassion and engagement. That's where we were.
Luckily, Bill was a longtime early childhood educator and had the confidence to do this. I'm not sure without him I would have ever even thought of it. So we made a family, and both Malik Dorn, and who was just 6 months older than Chaza, our early pictures are of them holding hands and them building blocks. Zaid then became Chaza's protector and really helped him into school and reading and friendships, making friends with people, as a model. And that Chaza would have gotten there anyway, wherever he was. But in our family, that was how it worked. And, it was wonderful to have the surprise family of three boys that I never expected.
And finally, Zaid, what it was like to do this podcast, this audio storytelling for which you were just won the best audio storytelling at the Tribeca Film Festival, of these public figures who were known all over the country, especially at that time, your mother, what did J. Edgar Hoover call her, the most dangerous woman in America, to tell the story of these public figures who you know so intimately, who you know as mom and dad.
Yeah, well, I mean, that was a big part of why I wanted to do this, is because I obviously know them very well, and I've seen my whole life the different public stories that are out there about them. And I wanted to tell a story that was about the people I know, not just my parents, but their friends and comrades, these people who in some ways have been represented in the media for 40 or 50 years, but I think we've never really actually understood what drove them, what made them want to, kind of conduct the struggle in the way they did, what radicalized them. And so for me, it was about understanding my parents, helping my daughters understand my parents, and I think people who listen will not only get a sense of the history, but even if you know the history, I don't know that anybody has seen, has actually heard these people at length discuss why they did what they did and what brought them to that place in their lives.
Zaid Ayers Dorn, creator and host of the new 10-part podcast series, Mother Country Radicals, from Crooked Media and Odyssey, featuring his parents, the former Weather Underground leaders, Bernadine Dorn and Bill Ayers. The series has been a top 10 podcast in the country. People can listen to the whole thing now, the whole series, for free on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere you listen to podcasts. We'll link to it at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Teresaina, Tammy Warnock, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Massoud, and Mary Conlin. Our executive director, Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.